Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. We have one bill to work today and an informational meeting on hearing from all of our student government leaders. We're going to wait on the work session until a couple of our other committee members arrive. So I'm going to open the informational meeting on student government priorities and invite Cassie Huber and Lindy Petty up to help us get started. While you are getting settled, it's worth mentioning to the committee our intention here. As we're getting to the end of our session, and you are getting to the end of your academic year, if you've not already gotten there, we thought it would be a worthwhile thing to check in with you about what's happening on campuses. We often hear from your presidents and other administration, and we wanted to hear from student leaders directly. So we're glad you're here and eager to hear what you have to say.
Thank you so much for having us, representatives. My name is Cassie Huber. I'm currently the ASOSU new president.
And my name is Lindy Petty, and I am the new vice president of ASOSU.
And we say that because we just got inaugurated on Wednesday.
Congratulations.
So thank you so much. And good news is that Lindy and I are already making history. We are the first double female president and vice president in the ASOSU history. So we're extremely excited to be moving forward in a progressive direction. And something that we want to progress is the importance of sexual assault awareness and preventative action at OSU. We provide a variety of services available to students at OSU and within the ASOSU program. One of our programs is sexual assault support services through our campus. This is a support system and staff that is there for students who are recovering from forms of sexual assault or harassment. We also have a program called the ASOSU Safe Ride. This provides services to students late at night from the hours of 6 p.m. to 3 a.m. all the time for students who are searching for a safe ride home. This is a very available sort of service to students that they can either call into our office, or we have a new application for iPhones and Androids to be able to request rides anywhere around campus, off campus, and we make sure that students have a safe ride home. There's also the Student Health Services and the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner, which is called the SANE program, to help recover from sexual assault victims and kind of the harassment cases again and violent crimes. We also have counseling and psychological services, which are CAPS, and that's a free service to students that comes out of student fees, and we're available 24/7 to talk to students if they should call into the office, and we also have first come first serve available counselors for students to go and see. There's also the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence a few miles away from our campus, but that's a service that Corvallis holds very near and dear to all of our hearts, and it's really a free service for people to recover from cases of domestic violence. So these services are paid mostly out of students' tuition and fees, except for the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence.
We may interrupt you as you go through
absolutely.
Questions.
We are completely available for
excellent.
Questions.
So, committee, if you have them, don't hesitate. Please go ahead.
Did you want to talk about Safe Haven a little bit?
Oh, yeah. We also have a program. Sorry. We also have a program within Student Health Services called Safe Haven. This is a program that initiates an online educational service to incoming students on our campus, primarily freshmen. It's an educational service to learn about sexual assault, domestic violence, and learning the importance of alcohol awareness and the types of scenarios that sexual assault and violence can happen in.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Well, I think it's important. I'm glad. Do you feel confident that you have a system to help people in need in this situation? Did you know that we just passed a bill asking all the universities to come up with a protocol? And did you have any input into that? Thank you.
Unfortunately, students, I believe, did not have an input in this new protocol that universities have to abide to, and I think that would have probably helped in really kind of emphasizing the importance that students really do care about this issue. I know OSU is taking preventative action, and so we just installed a new program that I'll talk about later.
Thank you for that. But do you think that was necessary for us to do that? Do you feel the program you had was
absolutely?
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for those comments.
Yeah.
We also have many opportunities to educate students on being aware of sexual assault and understanding how to take preventative actions. Some events that we put on this past year and we will always put on in the future is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which was in April. And it was a month-long month of events and movies and facilitated discussions and really just bringing light to this issue on our campus and making it go the entire month, so really pushing like the importance of the issue. The last major event was Take Back the Night. I'm not sure if you guys know what that is, but a lot of campuses partake in it. And last year, we only had maybe 50 students participate, and this year we had almost 1,000 students come and participate in Take Back the Night, and it was really awesome to show support for survivors and just take a stand against sexual violence. And we also, our campus was incredibly active with the It's On Us campaign. And every term we had various facilitated community dialogues where administrators, staff, and students came and really showed their support and interest in this issue. I personally went to many of them, and I was blown away that so many people filled these rooms and were willing to bring these, to have conversations about these issues.
So, again, our newest addition to OSU is the Advocacy Center for Survivors of Sexual Violence. This was part of their new programming for issuing kind of a major change in how we address sexual assault and sexual violence at our university. This office provides psychological and support services to students 24 hours, 7 days a week. It's a result of the growing need to assure students that they are safe on our campus. Is there any questions about this program? Yes.
Representative Reardon.
Thank you. So there's a tremendous, and thank you for being here, by the way, but there's a tremendous amount of work being put into this. Mm-hmm. So is that an indication that we have just horrific problems on campus, or, I mean, so real question is, how are you measuring it, or is data being collected, and is that data available to people like us who might be interested?
So I would definitely say that there is data being collected. However, it's very difficult to measure how many people are victims of sexual assault and sexual violence, because only 1 in 20 people report cases of sexual assault and sexual violence. It's kind of hard to gauge how much is happening on a university when students don't feel comfortable or don't feel safe in reporting these issues. That's at least what we've heard from the university. Going through all the educational seminars that we've been through and kind of learning about sexual assault and domestic violence has really opened our eyes to knowing that people feel very uncomfortable and very unsure of themselves after these incidents have occurred, and it's really hard to get them to open up.
There's a New York Times article some months ago that I don't remember the specific numbers, but it had a suggestion that the increase in reporting is not necessarily, increasing numbers indicate an increase in reporting, not necessarily an increase in incidents, but that people are more aware and more comfortable making a report of something that has happened. So that may be part of the answer.
Yeah. We are collecting some information and on those that are reporting. And,
yes, okay. Absolutely.
So is that information available?
I would definitely say it's accessible.
We could probably talk to Rob Ruff. Yeah. And get, if you would like information about it, we can definitely inquire.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure. I mean, yes, I would look at it. Mm-hmm. I just want to know that, you know, we need to know whether we're winning or losing on this. And, you know, if these programs are working, if the new protocols, are they working?
Absolutely.
And so to do that, we have to have some kind of data. So it's.
Yeah. And that's something I believe that we are starting to do, is we're starting to gauge, you know, the growth and development of our programs at OSU, not just for sexual assault, but, you know, for our student health services and the wide variety that psychological services provide on campus as well. So if you should have any more questions about other programs.
One assault is too many, but we still need numbers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, again, this is a new program that's at OSU, and we're very excited to see the implementation of it. They're actually in the process of hiring counselors and psychological services for that program.
So we just wanted to provide some information that our services take into consideration in their work and initiatives in creating a safer community for students. 1 in 4 college women and 1 in 13 college men will experience an act of completed or attempted rape. 1 in 3 relationships have a violent component to them. The most recent reported incident of sexual assault on our campus was on March 29th, 2015. A woman was assaulted in her own home by a complete stranger who happened to be a previous OSU student. Only 1 in 20 women will actually report horrific incidents of sexual assault, such as the one that I just described. And less than 10% of college students report cases of sexual assault.
Are there any questions on that?
All pretty factual.
Yep. So there are things that our programs can definitely improve on to be more accessible to students. We need to improve on ensuring students that we are a safe campus, and we want to make sure that our students feel comfortable and know that they have a safe place. We need to begin funding for the advancement of our programs so that students won't suffer increasing rates of tuition. And we also want to improve campus safety utilities like campus blue lights and hotline services like our 24/7 services. Only 2 of services on campus for sexual assault and domestic violence are 24/7 services to students. So improving on that and increasing funds towards improving those programs and expanding them would really help students feel safe and comfortable and know that they have a place. And equity and inclusion services, those are really important to students. There are cases of harassment every day on our university that aren't dealt with or aren't being brought to the university. And just to have a large program and let students know that this is a program where they can go and feel safe, talking about, you know, cases of harassment on our university would really be beneficial. And gaining not only data that is comprehensive towards a learning environment, but we also want to make sure that, you know, our students feel comfortable on our university. So that's kind of it for us. And we want to thank you so much for your time, and we really appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you about this issue. We're very passionate about this, and we would love to see more progressive change towards the issues of sexual assault awareness and prevention. So.
Thank you. I would ask one quick question, which I totally understand how you had to, given the constraints of our time, you had to pick one thing and go a little bit deep on that. Are there any other, just in, you know, 30 seconds, any other big themes as you are entering office that we should be paying attention to?
Definitely accessibility on our campus. We have millions and millions of dollars worth of renovations that need to happen to make all buildings accessible for students on our campus. It is seriously an issue. I don't know if any of you have been to Oregon State University, but I sometimes have troubles getting to buildings, and I'm completely able. So,
okay. Accessibility. Yeah. Nice. Anything?
I would definitely add on to that, and that we really need to increase, you know, awareness of our ADA compliancy or our lack of compliancy, because our university is very dated, and even as we continue building new infrastructures on our campus, you know, it's important to maintain that ADA accessibility. However, the older buildings where most classes are being held are very inaccessible to students. So I think that's something that we're going to try to bring light to this upcoming year, for students to be aware that there is a lack of compliancy for ADA regulations, and, you know, just creating, you know, that empathy towards more programming for accessibility as well.
Thanks. Questions, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for being here today. Great report. So as you talk about improvement, I'm just wondering, do the students ever engage in conversations with the administration about trying to change some of the culture on the campus that could be a contributing factor, i.e., I'm referring to, I guess, social activities that can sometimes, if we talk about, you know, people having a really good time, but leads to people, you know, being in kind of impaired states and so forth, that can lead to these kind of activities. Is that it? Do the students ever engage in that way, or is that just kind of viewed as being part of the norm of being on a university campus?
I would say that, at least from my experience this past year, Student Health Services really targeted leadership groups and organizations on campus to have these conversations. And I went to many of them, and they were very, like, people were willing to talk about them. And I especially in the Greek life, because that seems to be where some of the issues are stemming from. And Rob Reff, the guy who coordinates all this, is always going over there, and he says the guys and the girls are very receptive to talking about this. I know with the It's On Us campaign, the Greek system decided to do a whole video, and they did just a ton of stuff to really bring light to the issue.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, please. I'm glad to hear you reference the quote-unquote Greek life. I have a constituent who was down at OSU, I think, for Mom's Weekend. Was that a month ago or so? She's got a student that's in a sorority there. And she was, frankly, pretty surprised by some of the social activity that went on between the sorority and their fraternity, and just some of the out-of-control behaviors that she saw that appeared to be very normal. So, again, as we talk about these issues, I guess I would like to hear the universities being serious about really looking at some of the potential contributing factors. Yeah. So I hope you guys will feel free to speak your minds and be involved in that process too.
Absolutely.
Well, even around Halloween, because the Greek life is, you know, where a lot of the partying happens, mm-hmm. and it's a serious issue. There's a lot more hospital trips due to alcohol-related right. things, and it's something that we take very seriously. But again, it's a culture thing, mm-hmm. And I think, because I've now been at Oregon State for 2 years and going through as a freshman and then seeing things, I feel like there is kind of been a shift in sort of the administrative view of it and really driving home some of these things rather than just talking about it amongst themselves or really trying to involve students and especially the leadership on campus, which is awesome.
Thank you. And there's been more alcohol awareness programming as well for not only Greek life, but there's been tons of educational seminars for incoming students as well that really informs them about consent and violence when intoxicated or inebriated. So it's been a really great development on our university because I didn't have it as a freshman 2 years ago, and now it's a mandatory requirement for students to go through. So
there's... Oh, sorry.
Representative, I'm starting to feel the clock and all the other people behind us. So go ahead, Representative, please.
Oregon's changing. Yeah. July the 1st, you have recreational marijuana. You're also addressing that and have some educational things on how it can affect you and how you have to.
Yeah, I believe it will be addressed in all future. We have these things called start sessions for incoming students. It will be added to not only those start session educational portions, but it will be added to the Safe Haven programming as well online. I believe it's...
Well, we have a smoke-free policy, and I've talked with the person who is in charge of that, and we've put it in the barometer. We've tried to make it clear that we are going to be abiding the smoke-free policy and no substances, obviously, on campus.
Thank you. Thanks for your presentation.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks so much for having us.
We're going to stay at OSU in a different place here now, and hopefully we have Jack Vinderlinden and Nick Birdseye on the phone from OSU Cascades. Gentlemen, can you hear us?
I guess you can.
Very good. So if you could begin by introducing yourselves. Mario is at the controls on your slide deck. I should also say some of us on the committee had a chance to review some of the slides last night and noticed some similarities. I don't think we've encountered them yet, but if you are presenting later on and there's a slide or a stat that someone else has said, feel free to just make reference to it and say, us too, and in the interest of time, that will help us. So please go ahead.
Okay. So my name is Nick Birdseye, and I'm Associated Student of Cascades Campus President.
And I'm Camara Bidell-Styles. I'm actually the Vice President of the ASCP for next year.
Very good.
We can go to the next slide.
Go ahead. You're there.
Okay. So while on campus, we're really trying to enhance our diversity resources available to students.
Well, we're not at a traditional university, and we don't have a traditional university setting, so we're actually planning on furthering our student veteran program resources, creating a position that will advocate for Tacoma students, promoting and supporting a multicultural environment for our students, and then also advocating safe spaces for students who identify with the LGBTQ community and open education for allies as well.
And as we're growing and transitioning to our new campus, we're really going to try to have all of these services in place for our students to be able to succeed.
Next slide.
Go ahead.
Cool. And so as a broader goal, we'd really like to work in our local Central Oregon community on sustainable development, and we want to mainly focus on transportation and lifestyle. So we'd like to continue our partnership with Cascade East Transit to further expand the development of public transportation in Bend in the Central Oregon area, develop alternative transportation infrastructure and options throughout the community. We're planning on meeting with community leaders regarding alternative transportation and clean energy options, and to extend sustainable living best practices on campuses throughout the community and across the state through OSA.
And then in recent news, our governor classified the Deschutes County, where we are, in a state of drought emergency. And so climate change is especially apparent in our community and out here in the high desert. And we would like to be at the forefront of innovative and creative ideas for making our local community able to survive these changes. Next slide.
Okay. Go ahead.
And then our last goal is working in the community on the housing crisis and Central Oregon living affordability. So Central Oregon is one of the few locations in Oregon with less than 1% vacancy rate, let alone affordable options for our growing OSU Cascade community, which includes like students, admin, and faculty. So we'd like to advocate for affordable housing in Bend and Central Oregon, and encourage the development of the east side of Bend, and then also be active participants in community committees regarding the urban growth boundary and affordable living.
And so the screenshot on the right is just an example of what rental properties are available in the Bend city limits. We took that screenshot about 2 days ago, and that's just showing the available units to rent right now. And so many of the current students suffer from the inability to live in close proximity to campus, but let alone Bend and all. We have tons of students who are commuting from Prineville, from Redmond, and we feel that that's not a sustainable option.
And lastly, we just want to thank you for listening to our presentation and our ability to telecommute to you guys right now, and considering the needs of the Central Oregon student community.
We appreciate your willingness to share your perspective. I think I would ask a similar question I asked the group from OSU. You've kind of focused on a few specific things, which is understandable given the time constraints. Are there any other broad themes from your perspective that we need to be paying attention to?
Our real sort of goals for the next year is working on one of our main goals. We have a ton of veteran students at OSU Cascades, and right now I've been speaking to a lot of them, and I think one of the main goals that we sort of have is for the new campus to have a Veterans Resource Center there. I think that's something that's really important for the veterans of Central Oregon.
Very good. Committee, any questions for the folks from Central Oregon?
Study hard.
Representative Wisden says study hard. Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony and hope you'll stay in touch. We're gonna stay on the phone now and hear from folks in Eastern Oregon. Addie Beplate, the president-elect, and Gabe Tsao, I hope I'm saying that somewhat correctly. We're here ready to listen, and Mario's got your first slide on our screen.
So good morning, Chair Reed and members of the House Committee on Higher Education. My name is Addie Beplate, and I'm the new student body president at Eastern Oregon University.
Hi, my name is Gabe Sale, and I'm the current director of political affairs and also go to be the next diversity and equity director.
We would just like to take this time to thank you guys for having us and to address a few of the issues we see at our campus and present why they should be in conversation and consideration at the Capitol. So, Mario, if you want to go to the next slide.
We're there.
So, okay, when we were putting this presentation together, we just wanted to focus on what we thought were a few key issues, the first being sustainability, the second being sexual assault, and the third being cultural competency and what we call the regional struggle. Why we think sustainability at EOU is something that continues to be an issue is that many of you know there are continual budget cuts due to just our school being so small and having to cut programs to find funding and having the student fee dollar budget. And this ties along with kind of the incentives that are making their way through the legislative process. We've echoed that minimum wage is something that a lot of students and legislators feel would help students by increasing minimum wage for student workers. But we have considered this and thought, although we want to pay students more for their efforts because that would help them, many on-campus jobs at Eastern are funded through student fee dollars, and our school would not be able to afford that and would therefore have to cut jobs in order to do so. And that could ultimately hurt our school's wallet. We just want to find like more solutions for budgetary shortcomings that are on our campus, and I think that is a must in order to benefit our students. Next, I would like to just echo a thank you to Oregon State for their efforts on sexual assault as well. We think that that is a huge issue, and considering that it had two bills currently go through this past session, or current session, I would like to thank you guys for your efforts you've made on that. I think that is a beginning to the need that is felt on university campuses. I said in the slide that 1 in 5 women experience some sort of sexual assault or harm within their college experience, and that men can too become victims to this threat. Last time we were in the Capitol, Gabe and I had the opportunity to sit down with two elected officials and talk about how we could make this issue less of a problem at Eastern Oregon. And we kind of were thinking about how we could get a sexual assault resource on campus, because Shelter from the Storm, which is, I'm sure you guys know what that is, but it's like a shelter for people who have become victims of sexual assault, and it's a safe zone for them. And we had Shelter from the Storm located a block away from campus, and it got knocked down and has been relocated to the other side of LeGrand. So that's not accessible to many students on our campus if they don't have a car, or if they just have feel embarrassed about asking students to someone else to drive them there. And I don't think that that is something that is okay. I think that there should be a better resource for them on campus, especially considering the culture. And shame is a very negative connotation, but they feel that, and they would, that's a main reason why a lot of people don't come forward. So having that resource on campus would be of help to them. And we just think that that would further help your guys' incentive of having a protocol to follow. And then last, we have this kind of joke at some of the regional schools, and we call it the regional struggle, but it's a very real thing, and it transpires to a lot of the more regional schools feeling strained from the larger universities in the west side of the state. And over on the rural side of Eastern Oregon, we have some very different issues than some of the other campuses. And we feel that this isolation leads to a lack of cultural competency, and we're a little more conservative. And we think that we need to promote a more accepting environment, and also focus on a lot of the issues, such as Cascade pointed out about water, that are felt by more of the agricultural regions. So that's our presentation. So Dave had to step out. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you guys may have.
Great. Thank you for the presentation. I was about to ask if Gabe had anything to add, but thanks for the explanation as to why he was so silent. Any questions from the committee? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for calling in today. Appreciate your time. I understand you guys have a new president out there at Eastern. I wonder if you've had a chance to meet him yet, and as to what plans there may be for the students to share your ideas and thoughts with him.
That's a great question. I actually got to sit in with a group of about 4 students when we were interviewing Tom Insko, and got to make that connection with him right off the bat during his interview process. I think he's a great guy. I love the fact that he's an alum. We have a lot of very similar backgrounds, both being athletes, and I think he's going to be a really big asset for the school. I am also since I'm the new student body president, and meeting with him next week on our Board of Trustees meeting, and making other connections with more of the other faculty members. I ran into him this week as well, and he was just remembered who I was, which was really cool, and was asking about everything, and I think it's going to be a seamless transition since he's already so involved with the school. And as I was saying, I think budgetary problems are a big issue at Eastern Oregon, and the fact that he has such a great background in business and finance, I think he's going to be a really big asset.
Great. Thank you.
Very good. Thanks. Other questions?
Of course.
Okay. I appreciate your the way you covered several issues and what seems to me to be a nice survey. So thanks for you answered my question already in terms of covering the range of issues that are important. So we appreciate you being here and hope
you'll
stay in touch too. Thanks a lot. Victoria, that completes our folks on
yes.
the phone too. So shall we say goodbye to them?
Is anyone on the phone that still wants to listen in?
Good question.
Apparently not.
Okay, so we're going to hang up the phone. And you certainly could listen if you want to stick with us, but we'll you probably got other things to do and to study.
Thank you guys so much again.
Thank you. Bye-bye. So we have several people in the room to continue the conversation. We're going to go to Lynn Benton next, and Lena DeMorias and Michaela Martin, please.
And Chelsea Mink as well. We apologize
okay.
for not being on the speaker's list.
Okay, no problem. So I think this set of slides may be the one that I'm recalling as I was going through last night. A lot of slides, so I hope you're planning on moving quickly through them, please.
We are three very fast-paced women,
great.
So I feel like we can get through this.
Great.
We timed it about 2 minutes each.
Okay.
So for starters, I'm Lena DeMorais. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director for Lynn Benton. This is Michaela Martin.
Lebanon Center Coordinator.
Thank you.
And I'm Chelsea Mick, Clubs and Director.
Great. Thanks.
All right. As I'm sure you've seen, we have the three topics that we'd like to focus on today, which are open education resources, student parents, and students with mental illness. One caveat we always like to bring is expect unfinished business, expect to see us again, because these are still in their infancy and we will be continuing to work on them throughout.
Good morning. My name is Chelsea Mick, and I am the Student Life and Leadership Director of Clubs and Engagement at Lynn Benton Community College, which is just a long way of saying that sometimes I help out on my campus. I want to speak to you this morning about OERs, and this is not the last time you are going to hear about OERs, because this is a huge issue for schools and not just community colleges. Open Educational Resources, or OERs, are teaching, learning, and research resources that are available in the public domain or through intellectual property licenses to be used and repurposed by other people. So OERs consist of full courses, course materials, textbooks, modules, streaming videos, tests, software, even teaching techniques. Why this matters to you is because Oregon students want OERs. OERs can save us money, and OERs are offering us a quality guarantee that Oregon schools currently don't have. Lane Community College conducted a survey of its students and their relationship to OERs in the fall of 2014 and found that 62.1% of students refused to purchase required materials for their classes because of cost. Another 53.8% of students said that their enrollment was directly affected by the cost of materials. And juxtapose these statistics with the level of comfort that Lane students have with technology, and we've essentially laid out the problem: cost of materials and their desired resolution, OERs. Now, promoting OERs on a campus like Lane Community College has the great benefit of the opportunity to standardize the practice. So if we could share OERs across all schools statewide and use our association with the library databases, we could essentially remove all unnecessary textbooks, which would be a huge cost reduction to the students. One of the best fields to do this would be biology, or any STEM field, because the information is formulaic. Promotion of some STEM fields right now is a really important idea because it's the most widely spreading field of innovation. So the most concise way to explain why OERs are important is that as a student, I should never be required to buy a book that exists in its entirety on my school's library database or online for free. And by standardizing OERs across the state, we're looking at saving Oregon college students over $600 per year. You save us money, you save your taxpayers money. You know, your constituents. So Oregon students want OERs because they're going to save us money and they're going to give us a quality guarantee that we deserve.
Before we go on, I have to tell you, the committee is, I think, proud of a lot of our work, but I don't think there's probably anything we're more proud of than a bill we passed out of here unanimously, 2871. You may be aware of it. It's in the Ways and Means process, and we're all advocating for it, that would accelerate our OER approach. So we're big fans of what you're saying, I think.
Good. I'm glad. It's the next step in higher education progress.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to give me the clicker just so that I can. Thank you. So I want to talk about student parents. One of the biggest problems that we're facing with it is that we have very, very limited data on how many student parents are actually on campuses. National rate of students was shown to be about 25%, which is about 4 million nationwide.
25% of what? Because it seems like there's probably, 25% of all students are also parents? Is that?
Have dependent children, yes.
Okay.
In the home. And that was found with the Women's Institute, which was about the best research that I could find regarding that. Our campus has no data on student parents from none of our surveys. We don't we can't use the information that's provided on FAFSA. Because it also doesn't incorporate all scenarios. What I did find was really awesome results from Central Oregon Community College, which found that 30% of their students had dependent children. CUCC created a task force to try and address the issues regarding childcare and the issues that students' parents face. They found that the graduation rate for student parents was much, much lower than that of any other demographic that they had previously seen. Nationally, it was also shown that 53% of student parents don't graduate with a degree, which means more than half of student parents aren't graduating, which means that half of our parents are not educated when they finish school. They can't go back into the workforce. It also greatly affects the, kind of more traditionally marginalized communities, with 38% of African American students having dependent children. I think it was... That's okay. 27% of Native
Interrupt
American.
For just a second. Representative Rudin has a question.
Just definition of students, is it? Are we talking on this kind of data? Is it full-time students? Because there are a lot of students that go to community college for a lot of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
It may or may not be full-time. So
the data
curious.
From CSC was full-time enrolled students from the Central Oregon Community College.
Okay.
The data coming from the Women Institute was a bit more broad, I believe. So, but that's part of the problem that we've been facing is that a lot of these statistics are either really broad or not necessarily focused on the like differences of regions and where some of these numbers
I'm not sure how much it matters, but their status.
Yeah, no, I feel like it's really hard to address a situation when you don't know who, like how many people is actually affecting or what it would take. The average cost of childcare when they did this study in Bend was about $2,000 a term. They said if they were to like create grants to just give people money to send them to childcare, for even half of that, it would cost $100,000 to serve 75 students. Just 75 cost $100,000. So giving more grants isn't necessarily the best option when it comes to trying to provide more access and accessibility to childcare. This is kind of what it looks like when you have a zero expected financial contribution, about how much Pell you get, the educational opportunity, you come out to about $3,661. So if you're paying about $2,000 in child care per term in order to attend school, you're left with about $1,000 to like for everything else you can do. Some of the things that we're working on, the COCC created a list of options, which includes like workshop and access to more resources. The main one that we're focusing on is similar to what OSU has done. OSU has a drop-in daycare for their library, and we want to create kind of a drop-in daycare for our school, because one of the biggest problems, even when you have reliable childcare, like at the beginning of this term, my mom broke her foot. I couldn't take my two-year-old over to my mom's house with a broken foot. So I had to miss a whole week of classes because I didn't have, that kind of like emergency relief. So this, the model that we've come up with is you'd qualify for 3 days a week, 2 hours apiece. So it's just kind of meant to be like a relief. I can get a lot of studying. I can tell you how many essays I could write in 2 hours uninterrupted time. And also it would give that kind of emergency need like, oh, my babysitter's sick or something happened to allow for students to remain in there. Also doing it this way cuts out a lot of the liability costs since they're not changing diapers, they're not feeding, and they're not doing bathroom breaks, so it's actually quite a bit less expensive liability-wise in who you have staffed. So that's what I'm working on.
Great. Thank you.
Great, so I'll take this one. You already know my name, but what you might not know is I'm also type 1 bipolar. So when it comes to the students with mental illness on campus, it's something that I'm very passionate about. I'm also going into neuroscience for very similar reasons. What we found is that the number of students in college with mental illness is on the rise. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we are catching these kids sooner. We're giving them the resources to go to college. So what we've seen is we conducted a survey and found that, and these rates actually align with the national average at LBU. Oh my, I'm sorry, that's not properly formatted. So what we're finding is that roughly half have felt overwhelming anxiety or debilitating depression at some point in the past 12 months. Lower there, you'll find that over 10%, about 11%, have seriously, and I want to emphasize the word seriously, considered suicide in that year. The disturbing part, less than 8% have seen counselors on campus. A lot of it has to do with when they go through the high school and middle school age, counselors approach them. There's a lot more autonomy that's expected from college age students that a lot of times they don't receive those resources. They're not aware that they're available. So one of the solutions that we're looking at our campus is called Mental Health First Aid. It's an 8-hour in-person training that right now we have extended to staff and faculty, but later we'll be extending to the entire student body, low-cost, high-impact, evidence-based program, and it emphasizes the whole concept of neighbors helping neighbors. As a community college, we're very big on creating that community aspect. In the 2013-2014 legislative session, 21 states passed legislation or initiated executive programs related to this. Fortunately, Oregon was not one of them. And as you can see with this graph, there is still room for improvement. What's really awesome is that the Mental Health First Aid actually created a policy toolkit that I was checking out. It's very encompassing. Once again, all of these materials will be made available upon request. But it outlines model language, strategies for success, focal areas, you know, talking points, things like that. And also, it gives us legislative models to go off of. As I said, expect unfinished business. This is in its nascency, but we will continue to work on this and we'll likely have something drafted probably in a few months. But this is something that, as far as all of the remedies that I have seen regarding how to address the issue of mental illness on campus, really empowerment is the biggest thing that we can give our community, and I think that this is the biggest bang for our buck. It's going to be the most cost-effective, time-effective way to get this information across. So, yeah, we really just want people to know the signs and the actions via Lifeline. Everyone can and should be able to do that. So thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Questions for these panelists? You were very concise and very compelling, and you've anticipated all our questions. He does that a lot. It's a regular thing.
All right. Well,
thank you very much. Our next stop on our tour is Lane Community College. Ashley Jackson, welcome back. We've seen you before. As you're getting settled, it looks like you have a number of slides on OERs as well. Mm-hmm. You know we're fans.
You know
that our bill focuses on community colleges and components of the transfer module as well. Looks like you may be operating your own slides, which is fun.
Yeah, I can do that. So.
If you could start by introducing yourself, too, please.
My name is Ashley Jackson. I'm the president-elect for next year at Lane Community College for the student government. Thank you, Chair Reed and members of the committee. I'm here today to talk about open educational resources on our campus.
Great.
So, as you know, textbooks are extremely expensive. We've been talking about it for a very long time, and the rate of additions coming out makes textbook usage in classrooms, it's not really a sustainable model to continue on with, because every 2 to 3 years there's a new edition that comes out and students have to, you know, buy that new edition. What I really want to talk to you about is a survey that we did in fall term this year with the student government. We surveyed 788 students via clipboard with the student government in Augsburg and a couple other student organizations. And the purpose of this survey was to actually stimulate a conversation surrounding OERs, because I think that OERs is a little jargony. It sounds, you know, people don't really know what you're talking about, but they actually do, because there's many OERs we use on a regular basis.
YouTube. Maybe you guys could come up with a better name.
I know.
In my experience here, I say OER, and everybody goes blankly and say, you know, open source, and then they nod, and then they like it. You got to come up with a better name.
I really do agree. I feel like that was probably the first conversation that we had as students, like, why are we using this acronym? So, like I said, the purpose wasn't really to capture hard data, even though we did. It was really to get the idea of what OERs are and express that it's an alternative. Currently, Lane offers 40 classes that have all OER resources, open educational resources. And so one of the questions we asked was, how much are you spending each term on textbooks? I think you all are very familiar with this. But what I want to point out is that students are spending between $180 and $400 or more on textbooks each term. And that, for many of us, that could pay our phone bill for the entire term or even half a year. It could pay our rent. I'm a student parent. I spend over $2,000 each term on childcare. So it could pay for my son to be in an after-school program, which would not only help me but enrich his educational future. So we know that students are making choices to enroll in classes based on how much these materials cost. And what I want to point out, too, is that Lane Community College offers classes in sequence, and that if a student opts out of one class in fall, that could delay completion by over a year, and that this is something that's happening quite often, as you can see. And lots of students are walking into their classes without these materials. And I think that that really speaks to, you know, the success that these students are going to have and their access to that resource. I also want to point out that these students aren't choosing to not buy the materials because they don't care about being successful. It's because they're choosing between needs, fundamental needs, and you know, they have this $400 textbook in front of them that they, you know, I don't know, I choose to pay my rent too. So I also need to point out, we have a food pantry that was started as a student initiative on our campus, and we have an extremely high rate of houseless students that literally sleep outside on the outskirts of our campus and then come to school during the day. And the food pantry was a response to that need. And our food pantry is the most accessed food resource in our county. So it's not even just about our campus. The solution really is open educational resources. I do want to take this opportunity to say thank you for all the work that you did on House Bill 2871. I was really excited when I saw that up there. I actually soaked my instructor, got out of class for the day. I found extra childcare, coordinated a ride up here from Eugene just to come up here and let you all know that this was a solution to this huge festering problem of textbook usage in our classrooms.
It's nice of you to say those things. Our task now is to make sure that it gets funded in Ways and Means. So
yeah, absolutely.
Please keep your efforts up.
Absolutely.
We got the policy, I think, pretty well done. Now we just need to make sure that the dollars go with it.
Yeah, and I think it's important also to recognize that there's a huge coalition between librarians and administration, between faculty and managers, and that students have been... you know, we've been working on this since 2010. We actually funded an initiative through the student fee at Lane Community College in 2010 to develop and implement OERs. So that has been really successful. So as you know, open educational resources could save us over $1,000 each year, probably more than that, to be quite honest. And I want to point out that open educational resources are customizable because of the Creative Commons license or because of the fact that it's in the public domain. You can copy this text and increase the font to 14 point if you want to. You can have one chapter printed out and bound at a time, so you don't have to transport 40 pounds of textbook from your house to the classroom and back. You can have this information on multiple devices and not have to pay any extra money to do so. And that open educational resources are expanding Lane Community College's sustainability mission, but I also think that we're talking about social justice. We're talking about economic justice here when we're talking about open educational resources. I don't think that we talk enough about the shift in mentality and the ideology that's surrounding the commodification of knowledge. There's industries out there, there's textbook industries out there that are making billions of dollars off of students and off of our institutions, and they're truly the ones benefiting from this, not the students, not the teachers, not the admin. Students are very comfortable with technology, so and even if they aren't, we have resources that teach digital literacy and resources to help with that. So there's definitely been the argument, well, OERs, that's a a digital book. Not everyone wants to read a book on their phone. I don't. I like to annotate my text. So I think it's important to recognize that, one, students in the 21st century are very much used to technology. Second, OERs are available in hard copy format. Our students have, so we have 40 classes, I have to point out again, 40 OER classes, and 60% of our students have participated in a course that offered all free and online material that can be printed out. So you can see, like, that's kind of a large number for such a small amount of classes offered. And we did a fun exercise on our survey. We wanted to address the fact that the argument for quality has been made on OERs. We asked our students to grade the quality, and their perception was that they would have given the instructors and the OERs an A or a B on the quality. They did like this one. But what I think is really important about this, with the argument on quality, which we hear on Lane Community College on our campus from people that oppose this, is that Tidewater Community College has a two-year program.
Z degree.
Yes, and Oregon State University has the open access program, and we have an OER statewide librarian. So if quality was the issue, I don't think we would be putting work into bills like 2871. I don't think we wouldn't have accredited college as a 2-year degree. That is something that we encounter on a regular basis. So I do want to point out that our students have, with very limited resources as far as time and money, became advocates, did our research, we got out there and surveyed, and we've been lobbying our teachers, because our teachers, and I point this out because we're standing up against an industry that has all the resources to promote their products, their textbooks. They send shrink-wrapped packages to our instructors without a price tag on it, and as a full, you know, breakdown for every assignment, every test and exam, and a curriculum pretty much made for our teachers. So this is a dynamic that's happening on our campus, and we recognize this as an extremely large barrier to us achieving further implementation. So the point of that is we need continued support on your side, on the administration side, and our teachers and students to further implementation. Our goal this year is to lobby teachers to get those 40 courses turned to 80 courses. We need to promote and get those numbers up a little bit higher. So that's it. I know you've done a ton of work on that, so I do really appreciate it, and it was encouraging to see that legislation pass through to Ways and Means.
Just one more step. Let's keep our efforts up in Ways and Means.
Yeah.
Any questions for Ms. Jackson?
Well, this isn't necessarily just for Ms. Jackson. It might actually be from one of the four-year schools. But I'm just question about availability of courses in general. Are students able to get into the classes they need so they can complete a degree program within the expected 2 or 4 year period of time?
So maybe you can give just a brief impression of that, and we can follow up with if there's additional data. I'm still watching the clock a little bit.
Do you want to repeat that again? That was a little.
Can you get done with your program in the expected time? If you're a 2-year program, can you get done in 2 years? 4-year program.
Just in general, aside from OERs.
Are the courses available?
Yeah, can you get the classes you need to be done on time?
That's a pretty good question. It really depends. I'm going to say. No, because the fiscal health of our institution is suffering. We've been cutting programs. We've been cutting classes. And there's plenty of times that students come to me and say, I really needed this Bio 101 for fall, and I couldn't get into it because there's only one class open at one time in the day, and it conflicted with my work schedule. So I think that it's and I can speak only for community colleges because that's the experience that I have.
Okay,
so
thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Next stop on our tour is Portland State University. Sumitra Chetri and Marcus Sis. Why not, please? As you get settled, I'll make the standard request. I noticed you have a lot of image slides, which are very nice. Thinking about our time, as you can move through them quickly, we appreciate it too.
Absolutely. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Reed and members of the committee. My name is Marcus Sis. I'm an undergraduate student at Portland State University. Sumitra, who is on the agenda, is unable to make it today, okay. And she does wish for me to express her disappointment and regret for that. But I'll be happy to talk to you today. I'm here on behalf of the new incoming student leadership at Portland State University that will be serving for the next academic year. I would like to discuss a couple things with you this morning. One, to elaborate a bit on some of the ongoing efforts being undertaken by student leadership at Portland State, especially going forward into this next academic year. And two, to revisit the dialogue around the status of higher education in Oregon as it relates to student debt and state funding. At the end, I'll be more than happy to answer questions from members of the committee, should there be any. And if there's any questions in the interim, feel free to interject and let me know.
Thanks.
Now, Portland State is a really special gem here in Oregon and indeed in the whole nation. As an urban campus located in the heart of downtown Portland, students here are given an incredible opportunity to learn and develop professionally both inside and outside the classroom. And it's part of the reason that I decided to come to Portland State myself. PSU also serves the most diverse population of students in Oregon as far as state schools go, including large numbers of veterans, parents, and first-generation students who are the very first in their family to go to college. Portland State also attracts large numbers of students from across Oregon every year, many of whom return to their communities after graduation. All of these factors together make Portland State an important educational hub for our entire state. And I can't help but show off the campus. It's a beautiful campus. It's a very unique setting. We're in the middle of downtown, obviously, and that gives a lot of great opportunities for interaction outside of the classroom, as I've said. So I'd like to look forward at the upcoming year and some of the guiding principles of student leadership at Portland State. Incoming student body president Donna Ghazi and vice president David Martinez strongly believe that the most effective student association is one that's truly representative, and to that end are committed to actively bringing opportunities for civic involvement, professional development within the student association to a wider range of students. Having diversity of backgrounds and viewpoints expressed is always healthy in the democratic process, and the same is true even at a student level. To that extent, PSU student leadership will be making the spirited case on our own campus for additional student representation on our new Board of Trustees to ensure that student input and oversight on university matters are protected. Second, we're committed to seeking ways to improve safety for our students on campus. This is something that is getting more and more attention, obviously. More students are reporting to us that they feel less safe on campus than in the past. And to be clear, on PSU's case, most of these cases are not necessarily concerns of non-students coming in to campus and interrupting or disturbing the educational environment. These are really what we've heard from other campuses as well, issues of sexual assault, sexual violence on campus, in campus spaces that should be safe for everybody. As this issue receives more public scrutiny, and we do really appreciate the work that's been done on the legislature's part so far this session and in the past on this issue, we're really glad that it's starting to get the attention that I think it deserves. And as Portland State moves towards implementing new campus policing strategies, we will be striving to providing student oversight and input on how we can effectively and tangibly address these concerns in ways that actually make our students safer and show a potential for actually reducing the number of sexual assault cases overall. Lastly, Ms. Ghazi and Mr. Martinez and the team they're assembling at PSU will prioritize leveraging PSU's existing student resources and services and expand the reach to more students who can benefit from them. I think this is a really important topic. We want to look at these solutions, but sometimes some of the best solutions are on our own campus right in front of us. These include the Veterans Resource Center, Women's Resource Center, access to advising, tutoring and writing assistance, assistance with food security, insecurity, and so many others. And all too often, the students who would benefit most from some of these services are some of the ones who are having the hardest time learning and accessing them. It will be our mission to support these existing student resources and to actively promote their use and convenience to our peers who need them most, but who may still not be fully aware of what they can provide for them and help them. Bridging this gap is another practical step that our student leadership can take to boost academic outcomes for our fellow students and better prepare them for employment after graduation. Now, speaking to these student services, one issue that I just mentioned now is food insecurity among PSU students, and that's something that one of the other schools has mentioned as well. This is an issue that is becoming, frankly, much more common and widespread than I think a lot of us realize, than I had realized before I became educated more on it. And I think it would alarm all of us to know just how many of some of the hardest working students who are making purchasing decisions between groceries and textbooks, between badly needed visits to the doctor in the middle of flu season, or, you know, an even more badly needed graphing calculator piece of software that an Earnest student would need to be successful in a course.
There's a good graph on that on your slide, a few slides ahead, around the, there we go.
So this is showing the growth in college food banks, and there, besides the other school, I can't recall which one that had mentioned this earlier, there's other schools in Oregon as well that are implementing this. And this is a nice image of it. This is the one that we have at PSU. This was created 5 years ago in 2010 in response to some of these issues. And not only just for homeless students, but for a lot of students who are having a hard time making ends meet and are sort of on the verge of such a situation. And so since then, it's really become sort of a legacy project of ASPSU over the last 5 years. It's become one of the most utilized and effective services offered at PSU by students and for students, funded by students, and by generous community partners and donors. It now has its own dedicated space in our student union, so this image is of that space before we were running it out of our student government offices, and this has made it a lot easier to both store a lot of, more food, provide more access to students who need it, and also I think maybe one of the most important things is to reduce the stigma. There's a lot of students who can really benefit from this, who can benefit academically from this, who might not think of themselves as, you know, I don't need a food bank or I don't need to take food or something like that, but it's something we're trying to emphasize that a lot more students than maybe realize could really benefit from. There's no stigma whatsoever to using this resource. All this was done through collaboration between our student association, PSU administration, and community partners. It's something that, as Chair Reed referenced, is becoming more and more common across the country. And I think this demonstrates that PSU and other campuses, our willingness, even our eagerness, to tackle the issues of college affordability and accessibility in practical ways that are tailored to our own campuses. But look, having a food pantry for students in our universities would have probably sounded pretty far-fetched a few years or a couple decades ago, even. And it illustrates the dire challenges that many Oregon students are now facing for paying for a college education here, as you're all aware. The average PSU student graduates with over $26,000 in debt, as total debt from PSU students alone topped $150 million in 2013. Statewide, there are $1.34 billion in student loans taken out by Oregonians in 2013 to 2014. Now, it's no coincidence that this explosion in student debt has coincided with declining state funding for higher education. Our public universities are now mostly funded through student tuition dollars rather than through state funds. Perhaps this shall be the case for the foreseeable future. But it must it be so drastically weighted towards student dollars and tuition, much of it in the form of debt? I'd like to ask you to please take a look at these figures right here. So this is really interesting. It is showing by the amount a state has either cut, maintained, or grown its funding for higher education, how that has impacted funding on the state level for total expenditure as well as per student. So you can see that here, the light blue and dark blue are the states that have cut funding by at least 5%, and in some cases more than 20% in the case of the light blue. And then the orange and the red are states that have increased. The gray area is states that have had a decrease or an increase of 5%. We can sort of consider that maintaining. So we can see that most states are cutting especially on a per pupil basis or per student basis, are cutting higher education budgets. That's something that's becoming a norm here, and it's no different in Oregon. But this is what I think is really important to look at. From the same data, and this comes from Center for American Progress, using data from the U.S. Department of Education, we can examine the change in federal student loan borrowing per student by level of state disinvestment in higher education. So this relates with that previous slide. And what we see is that in the states that cut the most from state funding of higher education, you end up having the biggest increase in borrowing from students. This is just for federal borrowing, but this is also often the case in borrowing from private loans that come at a much higher interest rate and are much harder for students to stay above water often. Alternately, states which cut the least from higher education budgets also experience the smallest growth in student borrowing. Now, I realize to the members of this committee, most of this information is not new, but it is alarming nonetheless. And each year, students at PSU and in our public universities are burdened with more and more debt for degrees and educational training that are becoming increasingly necessary for us to be competitive in our modern global economy. As student leaders, we take it upon ourselves to help our peers and make their college experience a success, and we're making some incredible strides in that respect. But at this point in time, what we need most is a commitment from the state of Oregon to start reinvesting in higher education again. Many Oregon students, quite literally, cannot afford to wait much longer. And while others have already been priced out, more students are on the verge of that cusp. As our various student associations work on the ground at our own campuses to address these concerns of affordability and access, at PSU, we also look forward to engaging with members of this committee and the legislature as a whole in addressing how to reverse the long-term trend in declining state investment in higher education. We all love Oregon. We are proud to call this state home. We can all acknowledge the incredible benefit that comes with a quality education, with a quality college degree, and what that can do for economic growth for our state in general. But until we make a commitment as a state to do better and to provide more adequate funding for higher education, we will continue to price more Oregonians out of a college degree, burden more Oregonians with massive amounts of student debt, and stymie economic growth for our state. Marcus, but as Oregonians, we also recognize how unique our state is, how innovative our industries are, and the resourcefulness and trailblazing character of our people. We have so many reasons to be optimistic for our future, including everyone sitting here, I think. And with a commitment to reinvesting in higher education, we will be able to achieve so much more together.
Thanks, Marcus. You did a nice job. I'm sorry we're kind of running short on time.
Totally understand.
Unless there are any burning questions for you, I think we'll say thanks and move on to our next presentation.
Thank you very much.
That's Helena Schlegel, Sean Stevenson, and Claire Johnson from the University of Oregon. Please.
That's okay.
We got three chairs and about 10 minutes for two presentations. We do have to vote on a bill before we leave today. So.
We'll be
quick. Great.
Are you sure?
Good morning.
That's fine. Thanks for asking. Zach's going to get you one.
There you go.
Yeah, we're from the U of O. My name is Helena Schlegel, and I'm the new student.
Can you point the microphone towards you? It doesn't have to be very close, but just
new
in the general direction. That's
better.
Great. Yep.
And I'm the new student body president, and I also sit as the student on the board of trustees at the U of O.
Great.
Sean Stevenson, Finance Director, ASU.
Great.
I'm Francisco Morales O'Connor, and I'm the external Vice President for U of O.
I'm Claire Johnson, Internal Vice President.
Great.
I'm Casey Edwards, the Executive Director of Staff.
Great. Thanks.
Okay, I'll try to keep this one brief because the PSU representative did an excellent job. Just a few statistics. Oregon student debt, 72% of Oregon grads graduate with student debt. It averages $27,000. And if we look at the federal level, Pell Grant recipients, so that's lower lower income families and students, 88% of Pell Grant recipients graduate with debt, and that average is 31%. So Oregon really needs to help out and really take on the load, which is not happening. And we've seen a divestment from higher education. We're now 47th in spending per student. That's right behind Alabama. I have a rule of thumb that if you're getting beat by Alabama in anything, you're doing something wrong. So we're pricing out students. And I recommend that the next time any of y'all are at a college campus, just ask some students the choices, the difficult decisions they're making when it comes to deciding whether or not to pay student loans or pay for food or housing and other things like that. I think the easiest thing at this point that y'all can do is really support House Bill 3555, which is introduced by Chairman Reed. I really commend you on introducing that, Chairman Reed. I appreciate it. And as I know that bill will not come forth in this committee, but I hope as higher education committee members, you will all, or I encourage you to support that bill, as it will really help stabilize our funding when it comes to higher education, as well as education in general in the state of Oregon.
To speak to you from personal experience, as a freshman at the University of Oregon, I worked as an intern under the ASUO Women's Center. And from that experience, I created a campaign that initiated dialogue among students on campus about healthy consensual relationships. And from creating this program, I was able to engage in conversations with faculty, administrators, students of all backgrounds and identities on our campus, and I witnessed the overwhelming demand for sexual assault prevention and education programs. And working as part of the Organization Against Sexual Assault with Helena as well this past year, I have personally seen how hard and myself worked hard on how programs and resources towards sexual assault prevention and education are very much a big focus on our campus culture. However, it's unfortunate because a lot of these programs that many part of our community work a part of are not funded enough and therefore cannot reach as much of a potential impact to support the students that are so overwhelmingly desiring to these sorts of programs. And so we have a lot of resources on our campus, and I don't want to spend too much time on like going through all of them, but I do want to emphasize that there is an overwhelming demand from students, faculty, staff, and overall community members for increased support to the resources that we have available.
Yeah, and to add on to that, I'm a dispatcher for Safe Ride, which OSU already talked about, and so is Francisco here. But sometimes we turn more than 50 students away each night, and that's 50 students that aren't getting, don't have a safe way to get home. And so the demand for resources really is overwhelming. And to answer your earlier question, are we winning or losing? We are losing. There isn't a question. Like the Senate bills and the House bills that have been presented this session have been amazing, and I think we are moving forward as a state. But here at the U of O, it still very much is a reactionary measure to what happened last year. In the spring, and we feel like we don't have a safe campus, and we feel like we aren't, not enough is being done on our campus, and we need more state support to challenge our administration to make more sustainable changes to make our campus a safer place and to support survivors. For data, I know one of you asked about data. We did a campus climate survey last year. We found that 14 students per week are being sexually assaulted, and that's only the ones that are reporting that they are sexually assaulted. And so we have a problem. It's present. We have data, and we just don't have enough that's getting done to address it.
Perfect. So I'm just going to speak a little bit on marginalized communities. Similar with how the demographics are changing with the United States, so are the demographics of universities nationwide. Every year, the Emerald, the University of Oregon student newspaper, is always reporting our campus is becoming more diverse. And so that means that we also need to provide more support for those diverse communities that are coming into our university. And that means expanding resources and scholarships that are available to those students, as well as personalized classes that exist today that are currently offered at the University of Oregon for these communities, but expanding those classes and allowing more of those classes to exist, because the transition from high school life to college isn't the same for them. They come from different backgrounds, maybe immigrant backgrounds, maybe first generation, also non-trad students as well. So we just want to make sure that those students are receiving the scholarships and resources that they need around campus, and doing our best to find ways to find more funding for them or any way that we can support them and their families.
Perfect. So to sum it up on higher education accessibility, I really want to touch on the impact of physical accessibility. So a few years ago, Oregon State University actually conducted a survey on their campus in which they found thousands of infractions on ADA accessibility requirements, and that's because the ADA law was passed about 20 years ago and doesn't really have a lot of enforcement impact. And the United States actually has not ratified yet the UN's CRPD resolution, which is another protection for people with disabilities. And so with this lack of protections from all levels of government and from education systems, then people are allowed to foster an environment where people are not able to access classrooms and access the buildings that they need to in order to have a full educational experience that other people without disabilities are able to have. And then when I speak of visible versus invisible disabilities, I want to highlight the fact that people do have learning disabilities, which I believe it was Lynn Benton highlighted the fact that people are not able to access counseling resources and they aren't aware of these resources that are available to them, because people with mental disabilities and people with learning disabilities or people with diseases like multiple sclerosis and fibromyalgia, where they cannot, their brains operate in different ways and their memory problems, but it's not physically apparent. They do not receive the resources because people are not offering them the resources and the counseling center is not large enough to accommodate all of these needs of all of the students. As a proctor on campus for students with disabilities who need extra time for testing, so many students are turned away because we do not even have the resources to provide enough times for them to take these tests in enough locations reserved for these testing accommodations. And then in all of this, with having to have extra resources, it's an extra cost to students, and that's not taken into account when considering financial aid for these students. If you're paying, and it's just like with parental care and other similar issues, if you're not providing extra financial resources for them to cover that, then their loans and their scholarships are only going so far, and they're still having to pay out of pocket things that they really can't afford.
For just a second, Representative McKeown has a question.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Yeah.
When students enter a campus situation and they come with a declared disability and they're on a 509 plan, or I may have that number wrong, but they come with accommodations provided, are you saying that there are certain disabilities that aren't being recognized by that system, so they're not receiving the accommodations that they should?
So the systems, from what I've interpreted from what people have taught, my friends and peers with disabilities have explained to me, is that they understood it by in syllabi for different courses. There are outlines for if you need special accommodations, but there's not a clear outline through the introduction, which is what we call our student orientation program. There are no clear resources directly given to students for accessing these resources. And then there are times where, like I said, with proctoring and administering tests for students with disabilities who need extra time, there's not always the availability of people that work in that accessible education center to actually administer those tests. They do their best to accommodate, but there just isn't simply a lack of funding and a lack of resources and a lack of people who are able to do that. And so I understand where you're coming from with people who can identify their disability, but there's also other levels to that. So I have a mother and a sister with disabilities, and so that is a financial hardship on my family, which was not taken in consideration when I was applying to universities and looking for financial aid. And so there are other ways where it needs to be a more holistic approach is what I'm addressing in that regard.
So we got to be really quick. We got 8 minutes. We got two more people. Thank you. Sorry. So I got to ask you to wrap it up only because we've got 10 minutes. Perfect.
Oh, can I have one more thing?
Oh, yeah.
Just along with what Francisco was saying, just the idea of awareness. So there's even our Constitution Court on campus they just said that it was not a requirement to have gender inclusive restrooms on for all events that are held through the student government and just on campus. And so there's just a lack of awareness of the needs of these students. Mm-hmm. And so just highlighting that ability to actually accommodate student needs and actually help with presenting ourselves in a way that actually allows people to access all the resources that we have really needs to be improved on our campus.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate you being here. I wish we had more time. We got to squeeze the folks in from Western Oregon, Kellen Hughes and Nick Haugen. And then we've got a vote on a bill, hopefully. Kellen and Nick?
They stepped out.
Sorry. Okay. Well, let's do the bill, and if they manage to make it back in time, we'll be glad to hear from them as well. So, who's?
Gene.
Oh, okay. Okay. Great. So we'll.
We can always suspend rules and let him vote.
Yeah. Well, he may get here before we get to the actual thing as well. So, I'm going to open a work session on there. Yes, Senate Bill 483, and we have some -3 amendments. Representative Johnson, do you want to describe them, or do you want Victoria to describe?
Just move it, and then we can discuss.
That's fine. Yeah. Great.
Chair Reed, I move to adopt the -3 amendments dated 5/27/15.
Thank you, Representative Johnson's moved the -3 amendments dated May 27th, 2015. Do you want to describe them?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks. Colleagues, you'll remember we heard this bill. I believe was it last week? Mm-hmm. We had testimony from Eastern Oregon University, Southern, and Representative Buckley and Senator Bates. Both are advocating on behalf of this bill, Senate Bill 493. The basic ask that they have and that they continue to would like to accomplish is removing the provisions that are in statute that would allow the governor to perhaps intervene and or suspend a governing board if, in fact, the HEC determined that there were some financial issues after they did a performance audit and so forth of the institutions. And those of you might recall, but a little background is helpful to put into context. At the point in time that we, I think this would have been February of 13, 14, Victoria, help me out.
Which?
The bill that actually allowed the Trues to have their...
That was 14.
14, okay. It was a bit of a last-minute decision of that session, but... And there was a lot of discussion. As you recall, we had the hearing about the retrenchment process that each university was in. There were some real concerns about their ability to actually have a governing board that could be functioning and so forth, but we did nevertheless push forward. With the provisions in here, there was a review process that was a little unique and peculiar to them for very good reasons. So, and just as another backup, these university institutional governing boards don't actually take effect. They're not operational until July 1 to come. So they're still not fully operational, still not fully governing. So anyway, the point is they would like to not have that provision removed. So that's okay. But the problem we have, I think, is that the language that they used in here that talks about the governing board shall meet and vote on whether the university should retain or disband the governing board and so forth is a little problematic in that statute just doesn't envision the potential for a university board to just suddenly kind of vaporize. There is no other what would be the governance.
What question?
What would be the governance of that university? So the easiest way, I think, and I think the -3's accomplished this, is just to simply remove lines 18 through 26. Remove that whole paragraph that has the new language as well as the old language in it, and simply in line 16 above say that the HEC, if in fact they issue a financial review and a performance audit, if there's something concerning in there, that the commission shall notify the governor and the legislative body and the governing board of the board with its determination, and then we can decide what to do after that, but it doesn't prescribe something. So it accomplishes what they were looking for. It takes away some of the ambiguity of the language, and I think is a good way to move forward. So.
And the only thing to add to that, very good explanation, Representative Johnson, is that the speed at which we move at this point in session, I was able to speak with Senator Bates by phone yesterday afternoon. He expressed his satisfaction with this approach. And Representative Johnson, you managed to speak to Representative Buckley in a similar fashion.
We actually had a conference call with the representatives from Southern and Eastern on the phone as well, and they're perfectly fine in moving forward with this.
So I think we've covered all those bases, and the motion is on those -3 amendments. Is there any further discussion on the motion? Any objections to the motion? Let's see. So the motion is adopted. -3 amendments are adopted. Representative Johnson?
I move to adopt or to move actually Senate Bill 493 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Johnson has moved Senate Bill 493 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion on that motion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. Senate Bill 493 goes to the floor with the due pass recommendation. I think we'll ask Representative Buckley to carry. And that completes the work session on Senate Bill 493. Thank you. I'll close the work session. And Mario, have they returned? Okay. We will unfortunately not have the perspective from Western Oregon, but really appreciate everybody who was here and is able to testify. I think you helped us get a perspective that's a nice complement to what we have heard the rest of the session, and I think it's clear that it's just one more step in the conversation will continue. So thanks for being here. Looking forward to seeing you all again. Anything else to come before the committee today?
You know what we're doing
next Wednesday
is our next meeting.
Not Monday,
but Wednesday. Thank you very much. We are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.